Bye, my dear.
Okay.
Thanks for joining.
Thank you. Apologies for yesterday, Comrade Chaplain.
Yeah, we did extend your apologies yesterday, yeah, to the system. That's fine.
Good morning, Member Oka.
Honorable Oka, how are you?
Good morning, everybody. I'm doing well. How are you doing, Jay?
We're fine. Welcome
morning,
to the
show. Good morning. Good to see you, Member Oka.
Good morning.
Member Ryder is on the screen. Good morning.
Good
morning, ladies and gentlemen, colleagues. Good morning.
How are you?
Morning, Prof.
Honorable members. Morning, Chairs. How are you guys doing?
Fine, Prof. How are you?
Managing. Thank you.
Good.
The weather is getting better in Cape Town, too. We must think about moving back to Cape Town. Weather's getting nice.
It's so green down here, and the flowers are all out. It's really something special to see, eh?
Is that so? Are you still there? Okay. I guess we can start. The time is already 9 o'clock on the dot. Can I just request honourable members who are not speaking to mute their microphones? Just make sure that so that we don't have background noise interfering with the proceedings of today. This is a joint sitting of standing committee and select committees on appropriations. And good morning to all of you honorable members. Good morning, co-chair honorable Mashangu, support staff from both committees, members of the public who might have joined us, ladies and gentlemen. So we are meeting today. We are having the Financial and Fiscal Commission. Welcome, Prof and your team. They are going to be briefing us on the division of revenue 2021-2022. It means time is flying. We're already talking about 21-22. We spent most of the time under lockdown, but that's where we are now. And the FFC will be briefing us on the division of revenue. But that's before we proceed. Can I check with the Lubabalo whether we do have any apologies from his side?
Thank you, Sir President.
I'm sorry, Chair.
Oh, okay.
Before Lubabalo?
Yes, Chair.
Okay, come in, Chair.
Chair,
can you acknowledge the presence of the provincial delegates who are part of this meeting? And then Lubabalo will inform you about those who are not here, but we do have a number of them. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for that, Honorable Mashangu. We also acknowledge and welcome the honorable members from the different provinces. I'll request that as before we proceed, that we get to know which provinces are around, but you are welcome, honorable members. Lubabalo?
Thank you, Chairperson. From the Select Committee on Appropriations, Chairperson, we don't have any apologies, Chair, except to indicate that we also invited all provincial portfolio committees of finance or treasury, Chair. We have received 4 apologies from the Northern Cape, Chairperson. They've already been briefed on this subject matter. They were briefed on the 18th of August. We received an apology, the second one, from Mpumalanga, Chairperson. This meeting is clashing with their own scheduled meeting, but they have scheduled a meeting for this exercise, which will take place on the 11th of September, Chair. The Western Cape and Eastern Cape have submitted apologies, Chair. This meeting is clashing with their own scheduled meetings, Chairperson. Other provinces, I'm sure they are going to join us. I've seen some colleagues from, for example, Free State who are here already, Chair. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay. Before Yes.
Sorry, Chairperson. I just want to record, we did receive one apology from the Select Committee from Mr. Karim, who is attending to other commitments today. Sorry about that, Lubabalo.
Okay, no problem. We'll note that. But before I proceed, I would like the honourable members. Honourable members, please mute. Make sure that you are muted. Can I request the other members from the provinces just to greet and introduce themselves so that we can see who's around? Other members from the provinces, please.
Hello, this is M.R. Paladidi Ramela from Gauteng Province. Good morning, honorable members. Thank you.
Welcome, Honorable Paladidi.
Morning, honorable members. Sheikh Buzo from Northwest Province.
Honorable Buzo, you are welcome. Thank you very much.
Morning, Chair. Honorable Swahili, Northwest Provincial Legislature. Thank you.
Okay. Honorable Swahili.
Swahili, Northwest.
Okay, thank you.
Morning, Kabelo Matabu, Northwest Province.
Honorable Matibuho, welcome, Northwest. Okay, that's, I get...
Chairperson?
Yes?
You've forgotten about the apologies for standing committee?
Okay, please come in, Darren.
We received one apology from Ms. Ntlangwini, who is attending a portfolio committee meeting.
Okay. As a chair. Thank you so much. Honourable members, I'm co-chairing with Honourable Mashangu from the Select Committee on Appropriation. I think we'll allow FFC to our agenda is just a simple one. We have just taken the apologies, then there's a briefing, and then we'll have deliberations, and then we'll close. So, Prof and the team, you are welcome. Please take us through your presentation.
Chair.
Yes, come in with that.
I'm registering my presence, Chair. My name is Honorable Nsitsao Viola Musumi, Deputy Speaker, Northwest.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Musumi. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair.
Yes.
I'm Honorable Majaki from Free State.
Honorable Majaki, welcome.
Thank you.
Any other honorable member that hasn't introduced himself or herself? Okay. Okay, I think we can start. We'll take others later if they do come in. Hello?
Treasurer is also here. Treasurer is also here, Chair.
National Treasurer. The National Treasury.
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's for National Treasury. Who's from National Treasury? National Treasury, show yourself.
Good morning, Honorable Chairpersons and Honorable Members. This is Olorato Twele from the National Treasury.
Why don't I see you? Do you have video on? Come again?
Good morning, Honorable Chairpersons and Honorable Members. This is Olorato Twele representing the National Treasury.
Okay, thank you. You're all welcome. And see, the time is it's 10 minutes past 9. Prof, how much time do you need? We'll take you until quarter to, latest.
So that's basically, good morning, Chairpersons and Honorable Members. So that's basically giving us 40 minutes.
Yeah. 40 35. Minutes. 35. 10 past 2:15.
Well, we're gonna.
How much time?
We're gonna rely on your commitment to the process to allow us to finish the report. Thank you, Chair.
I find it 35 minutes.
I think 40 minutes will do, Chair. Really, I mean, be speaking to two committees and sometimes. But Chair, can I without eating on our time? Can I request that we ask quickly, like you've done now, the commissioners and the three presenters and the CEO quickly to introduce themselves, because sometimes I don't see whether all the commissioners are present. Can I ask you for that? And that shouldn't be part of our time. Please, Chairperson.
That's fine.
So can we ask commissioners? Start with the deputy chair.
How is everybody? I'm Michael Sachs. I'm deputy chair of the FFC. Pleased to see you all.
Welcome, Commissioner Michael Sachs. Any other person?
Good morning, Chair. It's Alpha B. Rockwin, Commissioner FFC.
Welcome, the Rockwin. Who else? Prof?
I don't see any other commissioner. Maybe it's off the CEO quickly. And then Sasha, Eddie, and Sheng and Kululi as the presenters.
Good morning, honorable chairs and honorable members. I'm Kay, and I'm the CEO of the FFC.
Good morning, honorable members. I am Kululi Ncube, FFC.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Sasha Peters, and I'm part of the research unit at the FFC.
Okay, Peter.
Good morning, honorable chair members and all. My name is Chen Tseng, FFC.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Eddie Rakabe from FFC as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We got a number of other researchers in the meeting, but they will get some time in the future to introduce themselves properly to you. Chairperson, the presentation that we're bringing to you is looking at sustainable financing of social and economic infrastructure. And we're basically looking at the need for South Africa's growing social and economic service delivery applications to be sustainably financed, but in the context of the deteriorating socioeconomic and macroeconomic conditions, and in particular weakened fiscal positions. Our submission essentially covers economic and social development in the context of COVID-19. We're also looking at sustainable financing of South Africa's public health care and the National Health Insurance Scheme. We look at the quality of social services, but also the inclusive nature of it. And for that, we focus even particularly on the vulnerable in South African society. We also give you some sense in the week now about the intergovernmental system in the context of social service delivery. And may I just add then, before I hand over to the team, that for next year, we're basically preparing to look at the effects of COVID-19 in the changing architecture of government financing in South Africa. We are preparing over the next weeks to look at what are those things that needs to be factored into, obviously listening to the two engagements that we had with the two committees, but also with Honourable Eunice's committee, that we're looking at what are the macro and fiscal economic issues, how does it impact on the organization of the state, i.e. with regard to government's obligations. But we will also be focusing going forward on total factor production and looking at economic and fiscal and social service interventions, multipliers. So with that, we're expecting that we will, going forward, also address quite firmly the issues of inclusion and exclusion and exactly what it actually means in a South African environment in terms of building livelihoods and obviously increasing the Human Development Index of South Africa. So with that, can I then ask that the team, starting with Chen, and then my understanding, starting with Eddie, then my understanding will be Chen, and then followed by Sasha. And if you allow, Chair, that they will just hand over to each other, and then Sasha will also take us to the conclusion, and then we're going to yield our time back to you and your team to ask us a range of questions. Some of the questions we will answer. Some of it will tell you as a collective that we will get back to you before the MTPPS if you kindly request us to come back. Some of it we will address as we go along. I also want to request from you, Chair, that we shouldn't only engage with you when it comes to us tabling our division of revenue, because we know that the two committees in particular has got a number of issues and questions they're asking with regard to the macroeconomic and fiscal framework, with regard to micro policies and the net effect of that, with regard to the level and quality of service delivery to our citizens, and what we've picked up in a range of areas, especially when it comes to municipalities, there's the issue of the business environment versus the public service question. There's also tension there. So can I hand over to Eddie, Chairperson, and then followed by Shane and Sasha to take it to the end.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to take you through the next few set of slides. Just to give a bit of a context and a background, we've already spoken to the committee about the slides. I suppose it's quite important that you always emphasize, I mean, the condition that we find ourselves in. Just to get to understand it, really the seriousness of the economic situation that the country found itself in. So we are facing this global and local economic green global economic outlook, which is going to require unprecedented fiscal and monetary policy interventions. So we've already seen that there's been quite a lot of interventions made by government, 500 billion from the fiscal side, and also quite a number of interest rate reduction from the Reserve Bank. Going forward, of course, we're still going to need some kind of interventions depending on how the economy recovers. Next slide, please. The next slide really just shows the continuing problem of the deficit. So that our deficit is ballooning, and over the years we've been struggling to meet our deficit reduction and debt stabilization targets. So which obviously make it's really limiting the fiscal space. So it's taking away the resources that we should be using for social services. We're now having to pay for the debt going forward. So again, that's something that needs to be arrested going forward in order to boost recovery. Next slide. The next slide again, just to really indicate so public spending is going to be crucial for the economy to recover. And over time, what we have seen is that the GDP has not really been, GDP growth has not been tracking economic growth. In other words, so as public expenditure growing, it does not seem to be affecting GDP growth. And in some of the studies that have been done, it actually indicates that there's a causal relationship between GDP and economic growth actually runs from growth to government spending, which actually implies that growth causes government expenditure. So in other words, the government needs to provide a conducive environment for growth in order to increase or generate revenue that is going to be used for public expenditure. Next slide, please. Next slide. I'm not sure what's happening. Okay, then I'm not sure the slide is not moving, but on my side, I'm on slide. The next slide just shows the socioeconomic dynamics that are currently obtaining in the country. Poverty levels are still seriously very high. So I think that's the condition that we're well aware of. I'm not going to spend much time on it. Next slide, please. Again, with the unemployment situation, the result, of course, of the COVID-19 and the lockdown effect is that we're going to see many more people losing their jobs. And government would have to come in, obviously, to provide again, conducive environment for the private sector to grow so that people can be employed, but also come with social interventions to ensure that those people who might have lost their jobs at least receive some sort of social protection. And as we have seen already the UIF coming on board, but again, it does appear that has not been enough, so we're going to need some more interventions to deal with the problem of unemployment going forward. Next slide. The next slide, just so on the access to service, basic services side, on healthcare, I think what you're seeing is that there seems to be some kind of a leveling off in terms of maternal mortality. When you look at all the comparison across all the provinces, the national average is around 119 deaths per 100,000 births. But you see that certain provinces, such as your Limpopo, I think, and the Eastern Cape to a certain extent have got high level of maternal mortality. So from an intervention perspective, obviously it means that the resources need to be directed in that provinces, but also to ensure that the institutional structures within those provinces are functioning very well to ensure that the quality of health services improves. Next slide, please. The next slide again just shows the quality of education across all the provinces. If you look at the attendance of ECD by school children between 0 to 6, again, as you can see there, there's an average of about 46.9 children who are attending home-based play groups. Again, you see quite stark variation across all the provinces, which means that there is there is some sort of variation in the level of access to quality education across provinces. So, from a resource perspective, obviously, and also for institutional effectiveness perspective, it means that the attention needs to be given to provinces where this quality of services is quite low. As you can see in this case, We've got the likes of Gauteng, which is not doing very well as when it comes to home-based curriculum. But at the same time, you see that the Gauteng has got quite a high number of children who are attending ACD centers. So again, that's the difference that we mentioned. From a matric pass rate, I think what we see in there again is that there's a some kind of a leveling off. All the provinces seem to be at the national average of around 82%, with the exception of Eastern Cape and in Popo province. Again, the intervention obviously means that from an intervention perspective, there's those provinces need to be targeted. Next slide, please. Just to come to the gist of the submission, as the chairperson has now introduced, the first chapter deals with South Africa's intergovernmental fiscal system in the context of social services. Essentially, what the really chapter tries to do was really to look at the institutional structure for the institution, the intergovernmental fiscal relation structure to enable effective delivery of services. So the way in which the IGFR arrangement and how they affect the delivery of basic services. As we have indicated, there's quite variation in the levels of access to services as well and the quality of services across provinces. And to a certain extent, that has to do with how the intergovernmental fiscal system is structured and designed. So in this chapter, we really wanted to focus on factors that affect effective functioning of intergovernmental fiscal relations for social services, with emphasis on governance, delivery, and funding challenges. So in a nutshell, the chapter focuses on legislative and institutional framework underpinning the intergovernmental fiscal framework. It reviews the basic education and health performance data available for measuring outputs and outcomes. So what has become increasingly clear is that in order for government to assess whether the basic services or social services are delivered adequately and to the right amount of quality, you need data, and so we will review whether the data is available. We also assess the feasibility of implementing the costed norms to improve the linkage between the allocation and expenditure responsibility. Partly this is a result of the concerns which has been raised on several occasions when we're making presentations to various provincial legislatures about the inequity of the provincial equitable share and how then can we make improvements to make sure that it treats everybody equitably, or all the provinces equitably. Next slide, please. So in the chapter basically asks three fundamental questions. The first one being that what are the legislative and institutional hindrances to the effective functioning of intergovernmental fiscal relations system for social services? And what remains to be done in the system of education, health, performance management system? So there's a whole lot of range of interventions which have been done, but it still remains inadequate. So we're simply asking what could be done to ensure that the system is complete. And lastly, what is the feasibility of implementing the costed norms approach in the allocation framework for social services? Just to give a recap to the members, the HFC proposed a costed norms approach in 2001 as a replacement to the current provincial equitable share formula, but due to data limitations, it was at that time there was a decision to not to implement the formula. But with the development that has happened over the time, we felt that it was perhaps an opportune time to review whether that system cannot be brought into forward to just to improve our intergovernmental fiscal relations. Now, to go into the findings quickly, the first finding is that there is a lack of clarity in the division of responsibility for concurrent function, which tends to create tension between national government and provinces in the process of delivering social services. Secondly, is that intergovernmental relations structures to foster coordination, good governance, and improved delivery are ineffective. So we've got a whole range of legislation which creates intergovernmental forums, but in our assessment, we find that those forums are certainly lacking, especially in respect of reaching consensus between national government and provinces. There's also another finding that the absence of standard methodology to estimate provincial expenditure needs exacerbate perceptions of fiscal imbalance and also budget gaming. So in other words, because we don't really know what is the cost of providing education at the provincial level or the cost of providing education at the national level. So whatever is allocated to the equitable share formula, sometimes this is subject to a whole lot of contention as to whether it's adequate or not. And as a result, you find that in other cases, there are genuine imbalances, but in other cases, they are just the cases of budget gaming because nobody really knows what the costs are. And as a result, I think we find that there's those tensions, but they also tend to affect how accountability work in the delivery process of those services. And the other finding is that there's a lack of norms and standards. Lack of norms and standards leads to variation in allocations and service quality across provinces, which also causes intergovernmental fiscal disputes. As we've indicated in the context, the contextual presentation, was that there's a variation in the level of services across all the provinces, and that is partly attributable to the lack of norms and standards, which make sure that there's a uniform delivery of services across all the provinces. So it makes it difficult sometimes when we have to, when the national ministers or even at the parliament level want to carry out effective oversight. And then the data side is that we find that there's insufficient credible data available to enable systematic and holistic evaluation of social services. So in the assessment, we find that by international standards, South Africa has about 44% of the capacity required to measure educational performance holistically, and 32% of that needed to measure health performance holistically. So we don't really have very good handle of what is happening in the health sector because of data shortages. The last one is that the current provincial equitable share formula is relatively allocative, inefficient, but it could be improved by incorporating certain aspects of the costed norms. So in our analysis, we find that there's data available to differentiate population by gender and poverty profile, which are mostly the factors that affect service demand and cost of providing services. Next slide. I will just speak to the few recommendations that we make. This table just shows you the extent of the data availability I've spoken to in respect to a health sector, but there's also the other table which shows these data shortages in the education sector. So it makes it very difficult for the system for the government as a whole to assess the performance of the sector. The next slide on recommendation. The next slide on the recommendations, Chair and Honourable Members, I'll just speak to the two recommendations. I suppose the rest the members can always read through. So the first recommendation in this chapter is that the National Disparity Department responsible for key concurrent social functions, especially education and health, must revise their respective enabling and subordinate legislation to ensure that the roles and responsibility for various sub-functions or activities in function are clearly detailed and linked to the accountability framework. So for example, there was an issue in the Northwest Department of Health. Again, there's always this disagreement as to whether when there's a failure at the provincial level, who must then take accountability? Is it the national minister or is it the MEC responsible for health within a particular province? So this recommendation is addressed to deal with that. It's more of an institutional kind of a design intervention. And secondly, is that the National Health and Education Sector Department, including the National Treasury and the Department of Cooperative Government Affairs, responsible for operationalizing intergovernmental relations, must invest in financial and resource and human resource capacity to conduct IGR consciously and emphasize the values of trust and cooperative governance. Chairperson, let me hand over to my colleague Chen to continue the presentation. The third chapter. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair members. So Chapter 3 of the annual submission is titled Economic and Social Development in the Context of COVID-19. The goal of this chapter is ultimately to stimulate a new discourse for a cogent recovery plan to adapt to the crisis as we see it, to invigorate that development by way of understanding where we came from, what were our social, economic, and financial and fiscal standings as we are now facing the shock. So we examine the market context as a backdrop, and as well as the for the financial and fiscal context, the chapter considers the fiscal implications to inform that reprioritization fiscal path that we are undertaking. And then the chapter, we argue also that we should embark on a localized product value chain approach of development and emphasize the need for basic municipal services of water, electricity, and sanitation, with that agriculture being the main focus. As indeed, without these basic services and a sense of localized production, there can't be any development of any kind. Next slide. So this graph shows the history of economic of South Africa's performance since 1960. The green line and labels showing the annual change indicates that the COVID-19 impact, that is the last significant dip you see there, is anticipated to cause the most significant downturn since the start of the data series, more than ever. But more importantly is, if I may draw your attention to the red line, the long-run GDP growth represented by the 10-year moving average. And this shows the structural decay that you see around the global financial crisis, that there is this structural decay that continued and before even started before the COVID-19 due to governance failures, institutional failures, credibility lack of, and policy uncertainties then. Next slide. So in particular, the impact of COVID-19, obviously we're repeating it, the shock on the economy and highlighted, especially though in South Africa, is the stark inequality as a sign of the structural fragility of our society that persists. And then that is basically that inequality, stark inequality, is even exacerbated with the shock, as we're saying, that with various new forms of inequality, such as the digital divide and so on. However, in the background, we identified two main roots underlying the high levels of joblessness and inequality in South Africa. As we all know, the apartheid rule has left the country without inclusive labor-absorbent industries and ease of capital for development. As the Commission, we recognize that unlike most other economies around the world, which progressed through the stages of inclusive industrial developments and involved most of its working age population across the skills spectrum. We did not have that. Basically, our industries, because of apartheid, matured and industrialized without sharing that benefits with many people. As a result, that persisted even post-94. Industries were unable to generate that inclusive jobs on a large scale. The second root cause, which is relating to the first, is the dependency. This dependency on commodity-based concentrated industries in the late 2010s, 2010, South Africa's main competitive industries were found in the concentrated markets of mining. This is also referred to in the literature as the resource curse, which is observed with most other African countries. This addiction in our trade balances to import solutions of products and capital as opposed to innovate internally to diversify our local production for domestic inclusive growth. Hence, with COVID-19, South Africa's response to this pandemic can either to try and return to these business as usual modus operandi, which no longer exists or applies as we see, as we come to realize, or to grasp that reality and an opportunity of the crisis to leverage it and effect structural change in the economy through industrial diversification, localized product value chain approach. Next slide. As a proof of the need for structural change, one of many, right, is that we look at this inflation or the general increase in price, or essentially between essential and non-essential items, or as we call it in technical terms, the core versus non-core inflation. With the data points up to done here up to April this year. Headline inflation had dropped down to 3% due to the sharp decline in economic activities and transactions. However, critically, is the core inflation remained relatively high at nearly 4%, showing that the COVID-19 impacts has exacted not just the economic downturn with a squeezing income effect, so people are losing jobs, the financial flows are slowing down, there aren't many activities to go around, but also the price effects on the vulnerable poor households that can't afford with these price increases. And that essentially threatens or removes the access to obtain essential goods and services to provide. And this gap between core and non-core has been continuing as we see it in the data series going forward. Next slide. With these significant, albeit a brief overview of the economic and financial environment in the context of COVID, the Commission observes that South Africa, despite masses of agricultural land, we look at the opportunities there now. Only single-digit percentages of that land, of our land, is under irrigation or crop farming. In the spirit of industrial diversification, we also note that the high levels of irradiation could offer an enormous opportunity for renewable energy for industrial growth in the local rural areas, with the potential to be competitively advantageous internationally. In sum, agriculture, as our commission is positioning it, is the key to domestic food security, but not only that, but also holds great potential for local economic development and industrial diversification. So with that, I move to recommendations. Next slide, please. So first recommendation is that we advise the Minister of Financial Development exact a clear, coherent, comprehensive macroeconomic framework that is in line with the President's Economic and Social Support Response Package to COVID-19. Essentially, we are here calling for a consistent approach and to strengthen that continuity of policy, consistency, and credibility of policy and of economic and fiscal stance. If we say that we are doing something, we do it consistently throughout. That is key to credibility and good governance. Second, after reviewing the economic situation leading up to the COVID-19 crisis, the Commission is convinced that a fundamental structural transformation of the economy is inevitable. Therefore, the ministers of Finance, of Economic Development, and Trade and Industry and Labor should jointly address the economic barriers, social inequalities and societal polarization by adopting this localized product value chain approach. Start from the people and start from the ground and build up from there. Next slide. The Commission argues that with the right infrastructural and financial support from the states, emerging farmers can be catalysts for local economic development and growth with the added benefits of food security. This is that last point with regards to this localized product value chain approach of development. And this would require ministers of finance and minister of corporate governance in charge of local governments to initiate that local-based economic growth. Next slide. I move now to chapter 4, which is focusing on the public health sector in terms of sustainable financing and the implementation of NHI. Next slide. The impact of COVID-19 pandemic is unbiased. As it stunned, we observed throughout the world, stunned the healthcare systems across the globe, irrespective of income, wealth, social economic status, and finance, even financing structures in certain ways. However, with that said, South Africa's health system is arguably amongst the most vulnerable, given the extreme socioeconomic inequalities and the two-tier system, healthcare system, the private and the public, that is polarizing in a sense. I just want to note here that the private, according to the Competition Commission,
And quotes, private healthcare in South Africa is characterized by high costs due to misalignment of pricing and coverage relative to demand, resulting in barriers to access. So this is key to understanding despite the unprecedented challenge posed by the pandemic, there are structural weaknesses within our healthcare system, backed by also the social economic polarization that is really posing a significant challenge to universal healthcare access. So next slide. So the chapter is comprised of two parts, one of technical and the other one of a more of a legalistic analysis. The first part, the technical, the empirical pricing and costing analysis to analyze the pricing of three major healthcare packages, the primary healthcare package, prescribed minimum benefit as per the Medical Aid Scheme Act for the private sector, and the third one, the proposed demand-based, is our proposed demand-based package, if you like, using this pricing and costing methodology to derive the optimal healthcare package, which I'll go into the details. The second part is this, examining the NHI reform in the context of the legislative and intergovernmental fiscal requirements. Basically, it's looking at that 2019 NHI bill. This next slide. The table summarizes this, the first part, the technical costing and pricing results of the healthcare packages. The result is significant, as according to the healthcare output cost mapping, the primary healthcare package, the first one, the PHC, is estimated to cost at about 2,198 rand, covering only, however, 27.3 of the healthcare service exposure. The prescribed minimum benefits, the one for private sector, if you one can think about it, is that it's nearly 10 times that. It costs 10 times that. However, with that money or resource, one can think of it that it's basically you pay for more services, that it's covering about 80% of the health service exposure, according to the cost mapping. However, if one uses this, then the third one, the data per patient, per healthcare services, by sub-departments, you dig down to the output cost mapping and target those sub-departments with the most patients and but with the highest exposures and sum up becomes cumulative distribution, as some economists might say, is then that could cover up to 80%. Of course, we can shift that probability to cover more, but with that ranking and targeting of pricing and costing and to finance those particular high demand department services, we can come up to about 13,000 rand, essentially much less, cost much less than the private sector package, but covering almost as much in terms of the health service exposure. Next slide. Through this costing and pricing analysis, they found that the current, we also found that the current, there are certain structural issues within the primary healthcare package as the list of requirements. Is that at first it covers relatively little, right? This 27.3% of the service exposure. And also we noticed that it's in the package as published by the Department of Health. It focuses a lot of its resources and attention on non-care services such as information, promotion, screenings, facilitation and education purposes, and managed mostly minor ailments. Most cases that require more sophisticated laboratory testing and or medical treatments need to be conducted at hospitals through the referral system. So this issue is particularly pertinent in the context of now the pandemic, as many of these small-scale clinics, they're not equipped or even capacitated enough and or even
as per the PHC package of primary healthcare, to deal with such a thing as COVID. And this potentially become points of contagion to increase the spread of the disease. So it, ultimately, this costing and pricing exercise not only demonstrates certain that through pricing and costing we can identify where and where we should actually focus our resources, but also change some of the structural internal details of those packages to in order to derive more of an efficient package. And of course, the with more data, more reliable data of this costing and output data, we able to derive even more efficient packages and with more accuracy or higher levels of accuracy. Next slide. On the NHI implementation, next slide, please. Okay, I shall just carry on. Okay, yeah. So on the NHI implementation, the Commission examined the 2019 NHI bill and advises four critical success factors. First is aligned policy and legislative framework. Second, determined funding requirements and funding sources for NHI. And third, defined comprehensive benefits for NHI beneficiaries and capacitated and consistent IGR arrangements. The fourth. So I shall just skip this one. Next slide, please. If I focus on this, the last one, the capacitated and consistent IGR arrangements in the context of this managing and management and control of hospitals versus management and control of district health services, I move on to the next slide in terms of demonstrating that. So first is the current flow. Arrangement of fiscal flows is that money flows through equitable share in the division of revenue and conditional grants via appropriations to the provincial revenue fund to reach the healthcare, the health facilities on the ground, right, as the basis of that primary healthcare service. And then next slide, the proposed funding flow then, as in the 2019 NHI bill, focuses funding through appropriations to the NHI fund, as direct payments on the one end and transfers on the other to district health management offices, to health facilities, essentially bypassing the provincial revenue fund and departments. Next slide. And that, of course, that would have a significant intergovernmental fiscal implications going forward. So in terms of recommendations of this chapter, first one, the ministers and the Minister of Health and Financial prioritize the development of an integrated national information system of patient and doctor registries with real-time data to inform healthcare financing and provisioning decisions using demand-based costing methodology. As demonstrated earlier, we say we found that with data, powerful conclusions can be drawn or cost estimations can be drawn for financing decisions and with a potential of savings. And this, the funding of this, or this establishment of this data system should be pronounced in the money bill, going forward. The next point is, point number two is that the Minister of Health must re-examine this PHC package based on the need of the people, refocusing from informing, promoting, identifying, facilitating, basically referring, to actually providing more healthcare services. This is, again, it's about realigning the resources straight to the healthcare services. Next slide, and focusing the resources to healthcare services. Then the third recommendation of this chapter is that the Ministers of Health and Finance must ensure that any enabling policy and legislative framework align among the spheres of government is put in place with due regard to setting norms and standards and enforced with proper oversight by establishing technical committees. So the things like that the benefits description of what is being covered and not covered in the NHI should be decided by technical committees as opposed to with data and evidence as opposed to subjective selections. And then the fourth, last point is to do with procurement. We note that we confirm, actually, through our site visits, that there
with the AGS, the Auditor General of South Africa, that we need to find ways to put a stopgap on the corruption and leakages in the system, and we start that with the procurement decisions of healthcare goods and services should be made by consulting health professionals and workers with necessary expertise and integrity. Next slide, I now hand over to Sasha to take you to chapter 5.
Thanks, Chen. Chair, I will take you through the last few slides. And this chapter is guided by the sub-theme of access to quality and inclusive social services. So it's about ensuring that all South Africans, irrespective of gender, race, age, and income, are able to access services, and not just any type of services, but access to quality services. So the chapter looks broadly at the area of family and community welfare services, and we hone in on bottlenecks hampering two specific interventions, namely the delivery of early childhood development education, ECD education, and progress with respect to rolling out inclusive education. And we've seen during the unfolding of the pandemic the huge gaps in access and delivery of quality basic services, especially to poor and vulnerable families and communities. And, I mean, we know that this is not something that's just happened now with the unfolding of the pandemic, but that these are issues which are longstanding. So just in terms of background or context, we note that there are numerous positive spin-offs as a result of stable and supportive families. When families are stable, they contribute towards greater social cohesion, which make for more stable communities. There are associations, abuse, etc. Further, the literature also shows that when you take a more proactive approach to strengthening families, so identifying at-risk families and putting in place appropriate support, that this is more cost-effective. But also that such an approach provides the space for the most vulnerable members in society, namely our children. It provides the space for them to develop and grow to their full potential. The problem is that the majority of families in South Africa face numerous pressures, from poverty to HIV/AIDS, substance abuse, gender-based violence, and child abuse, just to mention a few. So as mentioned, this chapter will look a bit broadly at the approach that government employs when dealing with interventions focused on families, and then we hone in on ECD and inclusive education. If we move to the next slide. So the first finding concerns the lack of a developmental approach to family and community welfare services. So firstly, family and community welfare services are very broad. They range from the provision of free primary health care to pregnant women and children, the provision of water and sanitation, the provision of subsidized housing, ECD services, inclusive education, etc. But ultimately, the Department of Social Development is the custodian of government's policy and program of action around families. And what our analysis shows is that there's a disconnect between government policy and in terms of strengthening families relative to what happens in practice. So in terms of the policy, the concept of developmental social welfare was introduced with the White Paper for Social Welfare, and that really outlined that government intended to take a more proactive approach to identifying children, families, and communities at risk, and the rationale is to move away from intervening after need arises, so towards moving proactive approach in terms of intervening before abuse, neglect, or exploitation of women, children, or the elderly happens. So this is opposed to getting involved when more expensive statutory interventions like alternative state care or protective